Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Heavy fighting continued over the weekend in Sudan as a new diplomatic process gets underway today, Monday.
The main message that's being delivered is, number one, the war should have stopped and a political process need to be triggered immediately.
A new survey says bribery and corruption are deeply rooted within various regions of Somalia. A Zimbabwe court on Sunday upheld a government ban on a campaign rally of the main opposition party. A Nigerian court orders the governments of four former presidents to disclose how they spent $5 billion in recovery money stolen by former leader General Sani Abacha.
These are public funds that shouldn't have left Nigeria in the first place. And now that they have been repatriated back, Nigerians deserve to know how those funds have been used.
And political parties in Guinea-Conakry have until the end of July to prove they are in good standing with the military government. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Reuters news agency reported Sunday that U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Marley Fee will travel to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on Monday and Tuesday to meet with African leaders and Sudanese civilians on how to end the fighting between the Sudan Army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. Meanwhile, the leaders of the largely civilian coalition Forces for Freedom and Change, the FFC, were meeting with African leaders on Sunday about ways to end the war. In the meantime, heavy fighting was reported on Sunday in Khartoum. Mohamed Al-Tahishi is a former member of the Sudan Sovereign Council and one of the FFC leaders who has been meeting with African leaders. First, I ask him for an update on the situation in the capital.
There is no major changes on the ground, especially in Khartoum city. Still, the rapid support control above 90% of the city. And the new images of the war in Khartoum is there is a heavy bombing from the military aircraft. This evening, there is an incident, 9 people being reported killed by the bombing from the aircraft, and that's including some children.
The Secretary General of the United Nations is concerned about the possibility of the conflict leading to a full-scale civil war that could destabilize the whole Horn of Africa region. What is your view on this?
I believe most of my people here believe if the war in Sudan been over-controlling, I think it is easily to could spread over the other countries, at least the neighborhood countries. But I don't think that is a moment we can expect it very soon.
I understand that members of the Forces for Freedom and Change, the FFC, you have been meeting with some African leaders. Who are some of the leaders that you have met with or been meeting with? And what has been your message?
We have meeting so far with the president of Uganda, President Museveni. And today we meet with the deputy prime minister of Ethiopia. And we meet with the Troika ambassadors and EU and some other internationals. The main message that we've been delivered is, number one, the war should have stopped and a political process need to be triggered immediately. And also we deliver the message that the civilians should be at the heart of this process. We also talking about the inclusivity of the political process, and we do need to see internationals and regional community come together and stand behind the One Platform initiative. And I can tell you the message has been well received by the internationals.
There are those who have floated the idea of an African Union-led peacekeeping force. Does your group share this view, or is that one idea that you're putting forward?
That's one of the ideas, but the reality is there is multiple initiatives. So what we need to see, we need a collaboration between these multiple efforts whether African Union or the Jeddah Initiative or the EU communities, we do need a collaboration that ends up with the one initiative and one platform.
Mohammed Al-Taishi is a former Sovereign Council member and senior peace fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Public International Law and Policy Group. He was speaking with me from Sudan's capital, Khartoum. A Somalia-based security research and analysis organization says bribery and corruption are deeply rooted within various regions of the country. The Hira Institute has just published the results of a comprehensive telephone survey that it says it conducted between December 22, 2022 and January 12, 2023, involving a randomly selected sample of 1,037 people. A Transparency International Corruption Perception Index released earlier this year ranked Somalia and South Sudan as the most corrupt countries in the world. Mohamed Mubarak is the chairman of Hira Institute. He says Somali security forces were implicated in about 44% of the bribery cases. Mubarak tells me the group undertook the survey to help evaluate the Somali government's anti-corruption policies.
This survey was done at the end of December to January. And during that time, the government actually disbanded the Anti-Corruption Commission and the Judicial Service Commission, which calls into question the government's willingness or also any commitment for anti-corruption.
What did you find in your survey when you talk about bribery?
In areas where the government is strong, especially in Mogadishu, we saw a third of people paying bribes in the last year. The whole country, it's 12%, because there's a lot of territory where there's no government, so there's no one to bribe. So we've seen the highest bribe-taking areas in the capital, Mogadishu, where the government is strongest and has the biggest presence.
You say in your report that one startling statistic is that the low rate of complaints lodged following instances of bribery. Are you saying that the people did not complain once they noticed a bribery?
Because the government had disbanded the Anti-Corruption Commission, which was already weak, there is no avenue for people to lodge complaints. For that reason, even those people who lodged complaints did not have their complaints addressed. So we saw, I think, less than 10% of people complaining.
Which agency or government department did you find solicited the most bribes?
The one with the most bribe-taking is the Somali police force. Almost half, I think 44% of the respondents say that they had bribed the police force, followed by the CID, the immigration, and the Somali National Army. Because of their presence and power all over the country, they are in a position to take bribes and demand it.
It was just in 2022 that Transparency International Corruption Perceptions Index listed Somalia and South Sudan as the most corrupt. Are you saying since then the government has taken little action in addressing the issue of corruption?
The government has taken, I would say, no action at all. So I would hope this is a wake-up call for the government to take action, not only to arrest random individuals, but to take the necessary institutional measures to bring back the Anti-Corruption Commission, which it disbanded in October of last year.
Does the government of Somalia know about your survey? Did you present it to the government?
Yes, we shared it with the relevant authorities. Yes, we shared it with the government.
Mohamed Mubarak is the chairman of the Hira Institute, the security research and analysis organization for the Horn of Africa. He was speaking with me from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. A Zimbabwe court on Sunday upheld the government ban on the main opposition group, Citizens Coalition for Change, the CCC, of Nelson Chamisa. The Triple C, as the party is commonly known, was supposed to launch its campaign on Sunday north of the capital, Harare. But police banned the meeting, citing problems with the venue, according to Reuters. Rejoice Ngwenya is an independent political and economic commentator. He tells me that the ruling ZANU-PF has begun to show its true character after reassuring regional leaders that it would be more open and less restrictive during this election cycle.
There was a time that Zimbabweans thought that the Emmerson Mnangagwa regime is on the right path to reconciliating with its previous past. A great number of signals sent around they were going to be very permissive in this election, you know, sending a few signals to SADC and world. But something usually triggers ZANU-PF towards a state of anxiety during elections. And I'm not surprised, James, that they are beginning to reveal their own character.
Why do you think they're beginning to reveal their own character? Why? What character?
We all knew that was coming. It was quite obvious. But what was not obvious, James, was the entrance of Xavier Kasukwere onto the political scene. That complicated Mnangagwa's life. So he knows, therefore, that if you give Triple C a chance to make inroads into his strongholds, that means that the few chunks of electoral support that he might have will be swept away by Xavier Kasukwere. So the Mnangagwa electoral campaign team is in a fix. James, this is very blatant. You don't stop the star rally of a leading opposite party and expect no repercussions. It's unacceptable. But that is the way ZANU-PF is going to operate now. The gloves are out and they are not prepared to take any chance.
Rejoice, the quote said that the opposition did not get, I think, notification from the police.
Look, James, I mean, can we be that naive as Zimbabweans? For an opposing party that has been doing campaigns for the past, 12, 18 months because of the by-elections, an opposing party that actually is aware that if they don't follow these basic administrative principles and rules, their rallies are going to be scuppered. Do we really think that we can believe ZANU-PF and the police that they were not given enough notice? Actually, it's nonsensical. There is a basic, strategy around ZANU-PF to prevent Nelson Chamisa from meeting with his constituents. And by the way, James, there is nothing in our constitution that requires police to give permission to anybody to have a public meeting.
Rejoice Ngwenya is an independent political and economic commentator. He was speaking with me from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 10th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. In Nigeria, the Socio-Economic Rights and Accountability Project has written to President Bola Tinubu to immediately enforce the ruling last week of the Federal High Court in Abuja. The court ordered the governments of former President Olusegun Obasanjo, Umaru Musa Yar'Adua, Goodluck Jonathan, and Muhammadu Buhari to disclose to the public how they spent about $5 billion in recovered money that had been stolen by former military leader General Sani Abacha. Abacha came to power in 1993 in a military coup and ruled until his death 5 years later. The Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project, also known as SERAB, had filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit for the records. The federal government of Nigeria had asked the court to dismiss the request on grounds that SERAB did not establish sufficient interest in its application. Kolawole Oluwadare is the deputy director of SERAB. He tells me that by complying with the court's ruling, President Tinubu would demonstrate that his government is different from that of preceding President Muhammadu Buhari.
SERAB welcomes the judgment. We are very happy that the court has sided with public interest and with the Nigerian citizens in this instance. When we filed the suit in 2020, we had expected this outcome. Even though it took 3 years before getting to this point in the judgment, the spirit and the letters of the judgment reflects the public interest, reflects the prayers that the SERAB had put before the court, and it reflects the will and the wishes of Nigerian people concerning the subject matter of Abacha Loot.
So why are you interested in knowing how much the government collected
Of course, these funds belong to the Nigerian people. It is quite disturbing. And of course, it's a negative thing that the former dictator, General Sani Abacha, was able to steal these funds away from Nigeria. And lots of it are yet to be recovered, by the way. And so when these funds, when the news made the rounds and it was in the public domain that some of these funds have been repatriated, naturally, every Nigerian was interested at that time and is still interested at this time to know how much of the funds are coming and particularly how those funds have been used. And these are public funds that shouldn't have left Nigeria in the first place. And now that they have been repatriated back, Nigerians deserve to know how those funds have been used, knowing fully well that these funds should be used in the interest and for the benefit of Nigerians who have been deprived of the use of these funds.
So what do you make of the, I think the Ministry of Finance telling the court that it had no record of how much money was collected?
It was the Attorney General's office as a second respondent that responded to the letter when the suit had already been filed in court, stating that he really did not have enough details about the abandonment. Of course, this could not be true. And at all, this depicts the lack of transparency and accountability in the management of public funds. The Attorney General's office, naturally, by reason of its constitutional function and statutory duties, should be in the know, having played a significant part in the negotiations about the repatriations and the use of the various funds that come in. And so we were surprised that that was the case. And we're very happy that the courts could see through that rather a shallow defense and ended up giving judgment.
What is your standing for bringing this suit?
Serap was and is still acting in the public interest. Our aim is to promote and defend the socioeconomic rights of Nigerians as a constitutional right and the various treaties and conventions and international obligations that Nigeria has ratified. And that also embodies the spirit of transparency and accountability.
Kolawole Oluwadare is the Deputy Director of the Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project of Nigeria. He was speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. Political parties in Guinea-Conakry have until the end of July to prove to the military junta that they are in good standing and should be allowed to continue to operate. The country has about 181 political parties, some without offices or bank accounts. A delegation from the Ministry of Territorial Administration has been contacting political parties to make sure they are meeting all legal requirements as the country continues with its transition to democratic rule. Faya Melimuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party. He tells me the ministerial visits with party officials do not amount to intimidation. Instead, he says the government simply wants to make sure that all of them are adhering to laws and regulations.
From time to time, they come to visit the headquarters of political parties to make sure that all political parties are functioning according to the law. So recently, they visited all political parties. They are political parties that refused to accept the delegation from the Minister of Territorial Administration. So what is being told to them is to abide by the rule, to accept the minister to visit and control how they are functioning.
Don't you think it's a form of intimidation if the Minister for Territorial Affairs can come and visit a political party? Political parties are supposed to operate independently.
I look at the political parties here in Guinea like the one in the United States. First, in the United States, a political party cannot go beyond the law. Here, to be a political party, you cannot unite with members of your family or members of your ethnic group and call yourself a political party. That's not a political party. You cannot have a political party. You don't even have headquarters. You don't make any meeting. You don't have any bank account as an organization. It is not a political party. And there are many here in Guinea. We have about 187. But we want to make sure those who are already authorized are being functioning. It is not an intimidation. From my point of view,
What happens to the party of the former president, Alpha Conde, and the main opposition leader, Selu Darlene Diallo? Because I know that Selu Darlene Diallo is not in the country. He may argue that maybe he's out of the country because it's not safe for him.
It is not related. As far as the party of the former president is concerned, when the people who are visiting political party headquarters call upon them to tell them that a delegation is coming to their headquarters to visit, they refuse. And they did it even when they were in power themselves, when they were controlling the power themselves. Why they will refuse today to accept the control from the Minister of the Territorial Administration? That's the question. And as far as Mr. Selu Darlene is concerned, it is not related at all. And as a matter of fact, his party accepted to be visited, and the answer to all the questions.
Faya Milimuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea-Conakry. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations, where Morocco made history at the weekend as they won their first Under-23 AFCON with a thrilling 2-1 win against 10-man Egypt at the Mole Abdellah Stadium in Rabat, requiring extra time to settle the match. Both Morocco and Egypt have earned their spot in next year's Olympic Games, set to take place in Paris, alongside Mali, who secured their qualification after defeating Guinea in the third-place playoff game on Saturday. Guinea can still secure a place as the fourth African side at the Olympic Games in Paris, but they have to win a playoff against the yet-to-be-decided Asian opponents. In rugby news, the 2023 World Rugby Under 20 Trophy will be hosted by Kenya. The tournament, which runs from July 15th to the 30th, has 8 participating countries vying for the title. This is the second time the East African nation is hosting the Under 20 Trophy since 2009. Ian Mugambi, the CEO of World Rugby Under 20 Trophy LOC, says Kenya is ready to host the second tier Global Age tournament.
Hopefully, we have the stadiums full. The more eyes we have looking at the tournament, the better for us. Rugby is arguably the fastest growing sport in Kenya, so having teams such as Samoa, USA coming in, obviously the Kenyan boys in Zimbabwe, will give a different flavor to the local crowd.
And now to tennis, where world number 6 Ons Jabeur was square off against two-time major champion Petra Kvitova in the fourth round of the 2023 Wimbledon Championships on Monday. Jabeur had on Saturday defeated Canadian Bianca Andreescu 3-6, 6-3, 6-4. The Tunisian tennis star says the match off with Kvitova will be a difficult one, but she is prepared for the challenge.
I'm going to do my best to be ready 100%. I know the next match I need to be focused. I need to be calm. I need to believe more in myself that I can beat someone like Petra. She plays amazing. She plays very fast.
In athletics, Kenya has named a strong team that will represent the country at this year's World Championships, slated for the 19th to the 27th of August in Budapest, Hungary. A total of 57 athletes, 32 men and 25 women will fly the Kenyan flag in Budapest. Faith Kipyegon will be defending her title in the 1,500 meters. Another athlete hoping to defend his title will be Emmanuel Correa in the 800 meters gold. Men's 100 meters African champion Ferdinand Omanyala says he's looking forward to the challenge in Budapest.
The last 3 weeks has been putting in a lot of work. And for me, running 9.8 is a bit of a surprise because we weren't expecting that, because we've been doing a lot of loading training. So that means the target of running 9.6 is close.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, July 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Button in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.